I'm Anthony Kay, and this is Sports Fluent. We have a special guest this week, Kostas Katsikristos, who's going to talk to us about strength and conditioning in EuroLeague basketball and how it translates to the NBA. Also, we're talking NHL. Who are the top four contenders this year and the top four pretenders? Then, the final installment of Jordan versus LeBron, the GOAT conversation. Then to the WNBA, we continue our team's preview. This week, we're talking about the Chicago Sky. Then to Major League Baseball, we are looking for a home for the Toronto Blue Jays. And lastly, in the fix, we're talking about the NFL's COVID plan. So stay tuned for all of that.
No, yeah, well, I'm come from Greece, hence, you know, as the name alludes. And I started actually by playing basketball myself, but pretty soon I realized I was not that good to reach the level I desired. So I quickly stopped, and when I was about, you know, 21, 22, I stopped, although I dreamed of playing professional. And at the same time, I was enrolled in the University of Athens physical education department. So I graduated from the university in Athens, and then I continued with my graduate studies at the University of Texas at Austin, where I got my master's degree in exercise science and sports nutrition. And my main goal, my main focus was to become a strength and conditioning coach. And I was very lucky and very fortunate to come across some really good and important people in the field that were kind enough to help me and guide me through my journey. And I have to say, I'm one of those people that I followed my dream, and my dream came true. I have been working in professional basketball teams in the U.S. Actually, in the U.S., I was at the University of Georgia as a head strength coach for basketball. And then I moved to Europe, where I held similar positions in professional clubs. And here I am the last 6 years living in Moscow, Russia, who is really cold. But you guys coming from Toronto, that's no surprise. But I come from the south. Yeah. But that's pretty much my background. It's, exercise science. It's about, learning and teaching how to become a better athlete and treat athletes as a whole and increase their performance. And the team that I'm in competes in a league. It's called the EuroLeague. So it's basically the, it's 18, I guess it's the best 18 teams in the continent, in Europe. Names like some listeners might recognize Real Madrid, Barcelona, and you know, big clubs like that. And we compete throughout Europe, and we compete in our local Russian league also. So it's 70 games a year, about.
Yeah, the setup's similar to what we would call soccer, right? But also for football, like, is the same EuroLeague setup like kind after of, basketball, sort of?
Sort of. The we play a lot more games. We play on average 3 games per week. So it's like more like the NBA setup in terms of travel and in terms of frequency of competition. But the names that compete are similar. They're right, just big clubs. Some of them are related to the soccer part of the club, I guess. It's like a university. Let's say University of Texas has basketball and football. So it's kind of the same some of these clubs.
Now, you guys were setting up a performance expo or of some sort. You tell us a little bit about what that was going to be, where it was going to be, what the plan was?
Well, the plan was to bring for the first time all 18 EuroLeague strength coaches together. And we've been talking, you know, individually and before the games, and we've been just exchanging opinions. And when we thought it would be great for us to A, get together, B, form an association, just like our NBA colleagues have done. And third, to reach out to the community and offer our expertise and our experience and knowledge to the rest of the coaches that would just maybe want to follow our path, or the people that are interested in knowing what's happening at that level in EuroLeague in terms of performance, instead of treating players, rehabilitation, and all that. So we decided to have our first summit, as we called it, this year, and it was going to be in Athens, Greece, because it's a city that is easily accessible. It has a lot of infrastructure for tourism, and the weather is always good, and it was going to be a good destination to have it. And but unfortunately, as almost everything got canceled this year because of COVID, We had to postpone, and we're having it next year at the same venue, which is the Hyatt, Athens Hyatt, Athens, Greece, from the 9th to the 11th of July.
Oh, so there's, I apologize. I didn't realize there was a date. So the 9th of 11th to July in Athens. Yep. All right. So how did this kind of come about? And I've got some follow-up questions, but how did it come about? Obviously, talking to the coaches, doing, is it the community outreach? All 18 teams are confirmed for next year?
Well, you know, it's not actually the official teams that started it. It's actually us, the professionals that work in the teams. And we've been talking about it on and off with some guys over the years. And the story is that this year we went to play with my team with CSKA. We had a game in Israel, in playing a team called Maccabi Tel Aviv, which is one of the classic teams and big teams in Europe. Yes. And I went out to dinner with a strength coach, and we just kept talking about how great it would have been to get together. And it was end of November. I said, listen, are you in for it? Like, you guys... you want to organize it. It was him, me, and another coach called Lucas Villar. He's coaching in Spain a team called Basconia. And it's just actually the three of us that ignited the fire, I'd say. We just put everybody in a WhatsApp group, and we just started chatting, and we banged out ideas and decided to have it in Athens. And the teams, we just informed our teams that we're going to have it. We informed the official league, which is the EuroLeague, that we want to have it, and they were supportive. So, you know, this was going to be our inaugural event, let's say.
Right. Yeah, COVID's kind of put a wrench in everyone's plans this year. Mm-hmm. So speaking of COVID, what are some of the things that, you know, you tell your players, because obviously you're not able to kind of get with them on a regular mm-hmm. basis because of this, and, you know, to everyone listening, what are some of the things you kind of give them to do to stay in shape as much as in game shape as possible? Mm-hmm. And do you guys have a date set yet for the return of EuroLeague?
Well, I'll start from the last question, which is easier to answer. I mean, shorter to answer. The EuroLeague just canceled last Monday. They just canceled for this year. They decided there's not going to be any more games for this year. The season is like it never happened. So there's not going to be a champion this year. Nothing is like it never happened, unfortunately. It was too much of a hustle. And, you know, Europe is very hard to coordinate because there's different countries that have different, levels of virus, if I can say that, or cases.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And travel bans and travel restrictions. It was just a big hustle to get everybody together because every team has members from different countries. And we had to bring people from the States, from Germany, from Russia. And it was just too much. So as of now, the next season is supposed to start on October 1st, 2020. So we're looking at a long off season, and we're just trying to prepare for that.
And October 1st, those seems like Greece specifically mm-hmm. seem to be better than, let's say, Italy. How is mm-hmm. Russia dealing with it? And is October 1st realistic, do you think, based on what you know?
This is a great question. Russia was one of the last countries to take measures. And we were the last ones in Europe to stop practicing. We actually practiced throughout until, let's say, I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was the March 26th, when Greece, which is a European country, also stopped, just put everybody on a strict lockdown on March 15th. And what happened is that Russia has had a big outbreak. And still they're in quarantine, and still there's severe restrictions and everything. They just started opening up flights. We don't know when they're going to resume. I want to believe that we'll be able to get into the country in the beginning of August and try to start normally. Now, I don't expect everything to be ran as normal. For example, as usual, we during preseason, we travel quite a bit to play exhibition games and take part in different tournaments, preparing for the next season. So I really don't know what's going to happen. And this relates to your first question, is what we're going to do with the players. And we try to send them programs to special platforms and just try to keep them in shape. But, a lot of guys were in an apartment for 2 months, basically walking out for the grocery store and coming back. Sure. So you understand that this is super tough to keep them focused, to keep them active, because these guys are running, jumping. You know, what can you do in 2 square feet or like, let's say 2 square meters or
exactly
whatever feet that is. And the mental part, which is, I guess, part of your specialty here, is that it's also a big question dealing with fear, uncertainty, you know, uncertainty of their future. Some guys don't have contracts, and it's just going to be, uncharted waters for everybody. And the approach should be multidisciplinary, not only just worrying about the physical performance, you know, a serious issue over there.
Yeah, no. And you took it right into my next question, which was going to be that psychological standpoint, mm-hmm. because, you know, not to say that all, but most EuroLeague players are in a position where, right, what do? Right. Just like their NBA counterparts and, you know, their baseball, every other sport, you're stopped getting those paychecks, right?
Yep.
How does that affect you? You know, are you still mentally tough to come back for older players, right? Do you even want to come back? Is the desire still there, or sitting in that, you know, small apartment or condo, or even, you know, even if you have a big, nice house, still being stuck sitting in there, right? It kind of changes your perspective on what's important. Have you been kind of fielding any of that?
I think you're on a point. Yes, for sure we have, and either directly or indirectly, you have players expressing the direct worries and concerns about continuing playing, especially for this year. A lot of them, like you just said, they lost some, you know, a significant amount of money because these guys have big contracts, but they were willing to give that up because of the fear. And then this creates a lot of uncertainty, and, you know, we take so many things for granted, and we were used to taking things for granted. And I'm not talking about this, you know, like the way everybody's talking about, okay, family and things like that, which for sure is super important, but we took for granted that our guaranteed contracts are guaranteed. But, you know, nobody ever accounted or expected that type of disruption,
right?
That forces everybody to say, my friend, I'm sorry, you know, your contract is guaranteed, but there's no money. And European basketball relies on sponsorships and big companies and significant people, you know, giving money. So maybe these sponsorships are not going to be valid anymore. So you got conversation, you got messages coming in with expressing fear, doubt, expressing fear for one's health, and there's multiple issues. For example, next, we're going to be starting our preseason in the middle of August. So most of our players have families. Now, the big question is, do you travel to Moscow with your family or without your family? Because, okay, maybe it's not that safe. Maybe I'm a little bit afraid. Maybe, you know, if something happens, I don't trust the local health system because I don't speak the language. I don't infer anything, but
right, yeah.
It creates an uncertainty. So do I fly in for this long season by myself? What happens to my family and my kids when I'm away and they're in the States or they're in Germany and I'm in Moscow playing? So
now,
these are questions.
So normally do they typically bring their families to Moscow for the whole season, and they live there for the season and then go back to their, okay.
That's what I do. I got twin boys, 2-year-olds, and we are all flying together. And now I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Even if I'm there alone, it's a completely different story. I'll manage to do my job, but the player that has to perform, can they stay focused without their families?
It's tough. You know, I have 6-year-old twins, and I don't want.
Okay.
I will take them to the grocery store. So I can imagine taking them to another country for, you know, 6 months. I can see where that could be very stressful. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. So multiple layers of concerns, and in Europe, I don't know what exactly is the current state in the States and in Canada. Getting support from a specialist, a psychologist or mental performer, or whatever it's called now, it's a little bit of a taboo. You know, everybody got it. Everybody's good. And coaches often a little bit, you know, running ahead of themselves and trying to deal with those problems.
And I would say, I'll jump in and say, I think getting help from a psychologist is it's a little more open or less taboo mm-hmm. in North America, mm-hmm. with maybe the exception of certain athletes, right? Because you're supposed to be tough and you're supposed to deal with it. Yeah. And there, you know, part of my show is trying to bring that awareness that everybody suffers from some type of mental, whether it be issue or health concern or whatever. It's just as important as hitting the gym is making sure your mind's right. And, you know, if that's something that's taboo and that they don't reach out to, it could be, this is a very difficult time, because very few times are we've never been in a situation like this. I never have, where you're stuck in a house by yourself. Mm-hmm. In some cases, you know, maybe you have your family, but you're really isolated from the outside world. And, and that tends to be an outlet. And you know this better than I, right? Athletes, their outlet is going out, and whether it be hitting the gym or playing, the camaraderie, you know, we talk a lot about, I relate this a lot to players who've retired. If you ask a retired player, what do you miss most? And they always tell you it's the camaraderie, it's, you know, the teammates, it's having that connection.
Exactly. And also losing your identity, because a lot of these guys are basketball players. And I often stress that, you know, you're not basketball is what you do, is not what you are. You are who you are.
Good point.
And just, you got to strip that, the fastest you strip this aura that I'm a basketball player, the better it's going to be, because at some point it's going to end. And people are not going to be recognize you anymore on the street that easy, because, you know, the newer generation doesn't really recognize you. And part of the camaraderie and you know, blown off that steam from during workouts and practices, it's also that. And a lot of guys just lose their identity and say, who am I? I'm sitting in the house doing nothing. My future is uncertain. I'm in trouble. And we need, as coaches, we need help. And I always stress that to the coach, that to our head coach, that we need help from specialists to know how to deal with certain issues, not only COVID, because nobody really expected that, right?
Right.
But for other issues that we come across every year. And you know better than me, being in that field, you know, deeper, that you got players that are, you know, from mild or light, let's say, symptoms, if I can use that word, it's not really good, but, you know, just being stressed and anxious, to dealing with athletes that have severe mental health issues. They're great players, but they're just carrying a huge burden.
And it could be a death. I call it, it could be death by a million cuts, just that everyday stress and anxiety. But also, you're right, there are some, whether diagnosed or not, that have, you know, clinical depression.
Well, I had a guy,
bipolar, right? There's all those issues that may go undiagnosed. Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, just coaches, we tend to disregard these people as these athletes as problematic. Oh, he's a bad character. Oh, he's a problematic kid. And then you got to dig in deeper. And I had cases that we dealt with some players that had, you know, severe childhood trauma. And being expressed in, and I just recently read a great book about that, and it just so happened it was just that. And he did consult with a psychologist, and it was a deep childhood trauma that just appeared as, you know, a problem of behavior or a problem of let's say drinking or things like that. So, oh, he's a problematic player. Well, no, he's screaming for help. We just need to have people around that will be able to recognize it, and these are the specialists that we don't have.
No, great point. So I'll shift gears a little bit and maybe lighten up the mood a bit.
Yeah,
so
that's good.
So tell me about, so obviously being in Greece, but obviously having been exposed to the US market, what influenced you to really get into basketball? Was it your EuroLeague players? Were you influenced by the NBA? And do you have some favorites that you'd say, yeah, I love watching this person play?
Well, you know, I grew up in a generation we all watched Michael Jordan play, and we also watched a lot of our local players play. So I have to admit that the last 10 years I've been focusing on more on European basketball, and I love some guys play that probably your listeners wouldn't recognize, like Spanoulis, Diamantidis, Greek guys, Navarro from Barcelona. And just love to see how the game changed, and being fortunate enough to be in it, I was you know, fascinated on how it became faster, how it became more, you know, players became more athletic, and how it just shifted from this slower, more delicate game to this power game that it is now. And of course, the NBA is leading the way in this, so it's fascinating to watch. I don't follow one player, but I just try to see the whole advancement of this game.
Okay. So I, you know, obviously here, I'm not sure if you guys had it. We've just been, glued to our TVs watching The Last Dance.
Absolutely.
So that it's brought back a lot of memories about Jordan and those goals in those days. So, It's brought, that's why I asked the conversation, because obviously, yep, especially that 92 dream team, you know,
absolutely
traveling,
you know, us living in Greece, and in the 90s, we didn't get, of course there was no internet, and you know, the younger generation, maybe it's harder to connect. And what do you mean there was no YouTube? Just put in 1992 and you watch everything. And we were waiting, and obviously there's a time difference between America and Europe. And I remember, you know, just graduated from high school and being in university and just staying up late until 4 a.m. to catch this Bulls game, that it was the Greek television televised the playoffs, the NBA playoffs. And this is where we got this look through the keyhole, let's say, to watch all these greats play. We didn't have year-round, you know, just the normal NBA. So it was fast. That's why it stuck, and it's just watching this The Last Dance just brought back so many memories, so different levels, not only right. basketball, but it's fun. And to be honest, I watched the first three, and then I'm saving it to watch when I have more time, and I'm just going to watch it all at once. They're just going to sit in one night and watch it all.
Well, I watched all 10 as they came out.
Okay.
But I'm already saying, okay, I got to go back and binge watch and just watch them all 10 in a row, because I'm sure I missed something.
And
it brings me to my last question, and then I'll let you go, because I know it's late over there.
Okay, thanks.
What, in your travels, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know you're not ready for this one, so I'll give you a second to think about it. But I always like to ask, was there like a really good story or a great funny story or an embarrassing thing? Like, as you're traveling around as a player, as a coach, what was something that kind of sticks out in your mind? You're like, oh, I'll never forget this time.
Wow.
Try to keep it, and unfortunately, try to keep it clean.
You know, it's going to be clean. There's so many stories that one thing that, you know, can I use something that it was to my, let's say, so the one thing that stuck to me, and I always bring it back with a funny memory, is that when I was in the University of Texas, I got an internship at a place called Athletes Performance. Now it's called Exos. It's in Arizona, and I was in Austin, and it was August, and people in the States can relate. It was like 150 degrees. I don't know. And I
lived in Arizona, and I tell everybody how hot it was, and they still don't believe me. So
okay,
I'm with you so far.
Okay, so I had to drive because I just got this great opportunity, and I have to say that this place, Exos, is maybe the best place to train athletes in the world. And I just got an internship, and there was like 100 applicants, and I was one of the 5 or 6 people that they accepted, and it was so thrilled. And I had to drive from Austin, Texas, to Arizona, and I had a Mercedes car, an 84 Mercedes. I just bought like $3,000, and the thing is that the car was old and I didn't have an AC, and the windows wouldn't roll because the electronics were damaged. I had no money to fix it. So I drove from Austin, Texas to Arizona in August with just a rooftop. It had a small rooftop that it opened, and the only air coming in was from there. And it has also mechanical problems. So I had to drive through the desert in 2 days. A Greek kid, just, you know, 2 years in the States, just driving to the unknown without GPS, without anything. It was just because there was no GPS at that point.
It was paper maps. Yeah, most people don't remember those.
Printed map
yeah.
that they send me, and I just drove through. And for me, I was passing, you know, these landmarks of you know, this battle happened here with the Apaches and things like. It was just like being in a Western movie. And you have to understand, me coming from a different planet, which is Greece, and I always say the story. Say, you know what? I just put, you know, 2 suitcases was all I had, and drove through that. And thinking of it now, it was stupid and dangerous. Both,
well,
because
unless you're trying to make weight, because you probably had a good sweat going.
Oh my, yeah. Well, you know, surprisingly, I don't suggest for anybody to try this. It's a significant amount of air that comes through that rooftop opening. So don't try it, but if you have to do it, you'll survive. You know, and make sure you start your trip at 5 a.m. Which I did, because I could have less sun, you know.
That's fantastic. Terrible at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. That was my story. I have a lot, but this I always say the story. I just you know, it stuck to me, and I don't know.
It was fantastic. All right. Well, on that note, Kostas, thank you so much for your time today. I definitely appreciate it. It was great. And good luck when the season kicks back off and with your summit next summer.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the summit and all the experiences, and have a good, day. And thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
This week, we're going to take a look at the top four contenders for the Stanley Cup, plus the top four pretenders. We're going to kick it off with everyone's favorite, except here in Toronto, the Boston Bruins. Now, Boston has a great chance of getting back to the Stanley Cup this year, and as you know, I have them picked losing in the final. But what makes them such a competitor? Why are they a true contender for the Cup? They are fantastic at puck movement. It's one of the nicest teams to watch on the ice. Plus, they have the two things that I consider almost the most important things for a hockey team to be successful. Great defense and phenomenal goaltending. They have it both. Why do I think they might not win the Stanley Cup this year? They're not that great when it's on 5-on-5. And they take too many perimeter shots when they start to get frazzled. I think that little bit is going to be enough for my team, or my pick, to beat them in the Stanley Cup Finals. Contender number two, the Philadelphia Flyers. They may have the return of Nolan Patrick, which I think helps them exponentially, but let's assume he's not healthy and doesn't come back. They still have really good forward depth and a goalie in Carter Hart that I can't wait to see in this type of playoff situation, especially in these empty stadiums where, for a younger goalie, I think he's less likely to get rattled. What's going to hurt them and their chances? They were really hot going into kind of the COVID shutdown. And did the layoff cool the team off? Did it hurt their team chemistry? That's going to be a question that will need to be answered as we get back into play. The third contender, the Las Vegas Golden Knights. This team is one of the best defensive teams in the league, probably only second to the Boston Bruins, and they look very similar in the way that they play. They're first in turnovers, in turnover rate, and third in the defensive zone in turnover rate. So this team takes a lot of chances from getting defensive turnovers and turns them into offensive opportunities. Where they could be vulnerable, of course, is if they decide to go with Fleury and Net. He can be erratic at times. And I think they give up too many rebounds for someone to win a Stanley Cup. But again, I think they're going to be right in that mix. Now for your favorite part, the top four pretenders. So I left out lower standing teams. I left out the Toronto Maple Leafs, who are going to make some noise in the first round, but then fizzle out. And I focused on really top tier teams that should have a chance, but they're really not going to make it that far. Starting off with the Dallas Stars. They were second in defense, which is a huge plus. And if you've heard how I talk about hockey, you know I think defense and goaltending is really important. However, their defensive scheme is very much built on structure. And I think the layoff will hurt that disciplined defense that they play. Also, they have a veteran lineup, and I'm not sure how they're going to react to this long layoff and if they'll be able to get going fast enough to make noise in the playoffs. Lastly, for as great as they can be on defense, they find it difficult to score goals. And so I think that keeps them out of the true conversation of Stanley Cup contender. Next to the St. Louis Blues. Now this one I struggled with. They're the defending champs. They had a long layoff to get their legs fresh. And when you have Jordan Binnington in net, you have a shot. But I just don't think that they're going to be hungry enough coming out of the break for this. This might be more of a mental situation for me than anything that the team does on the ice or their ability on the ice. And because so few teams in the NHL are able to win back-to-back championships, I've pushed them out of the conversation. Third, the Tampa Bay Lightning. So this team is great, and in terms of their cycle chances, they're second only to the Toronto Maple Leafs. So they do get a lot of chances on the attack. However, they don't always use their speed to attack off the rush. That's a problem. I think if they were to do that, it might put them back into the conversation. The other side, of course, they'd struggle a little bit on defense, especially against the rush, giving up the sixth most chances of all the teams in the NHL. That's not a championship makeup. So I've taken the Tampa Bay Lightning into the pretenders bucket. And the last pretender, and this is one that I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of heat for, but is the Washington Capitals. Yes, I know this team reminds you of the 2018 Cup champion Capitals, and with Ovechkin on the team, you know that they're going to be strong offensively. However, I have two big question marks that puts them in the pretender pile for me. The first one, Holtby, is shaky in net, and unless he somehow finds a way to get really hot heading into the playoffs, I don't think he's going to be strong enough to carry them all the way through. Why don't I think he's going to get hot? Is because I have some question marks about that blue line. And if your blue line isn't strong and the opposing team gets chances, it's less likely that a goalie can get hot. So I'm putting the Capitals in the pretender pile. It's funny how something that I never wanted to do became so enjoyable. I've been watching tape and videos and reading articles and doing so much homework and research on Jordan versus LeBron that it made me, one, remember how great Michael Jordan was and how amazing it was to watch him through his college and NBA career. It also gave me, not that I didn't have one already, but a newfound appreciation for what I'm watching live every day, or at least once the NBA comes back, with LeBron James, a truly phenomenal, exceptional athlete. So as I went through this, you know, I've told you multiple times, it's not a debate that I wanted to have. I think they're the two best NBA players in the history of the game. And look, there's another 5 or 10 that really deserve our respect and accolades and appreciation. And I think we should appreciate all the greats throughout the history of the NBA. That being said, you kept asking me to do this debate. So it brings us to the final component. And it's the one that's obviously the most subjective because it's the eye test. Watching a player, understanding the game of basketball, its history, its future, having played the game, ref the game, taught the game, and coached the game, I hope I have some insight into what I'm watching and what looks good and what makes sense and those types of, you know, those little intricacies and facets of the game and fundamentals that maybe everyone doesn't appreciate. So when it comes to the eye test, as much as I keep going back to certain statistics, I'm going to try and keep them out of this and just think and review the tape, which I've done over and over again. And there's certain things that I asked myself as I looked at this. Who would I want on my team? Who would I want to lead my team? Who, when it matters most, delivers the most opportunity for your team to win? And as I watched, again, all that tape, the decision became clearer the more I watched, and it wasn't. It was foggy in the beginning. So let's start with LeBron James. When you watch LeBron James, you understand this is a physically dominating specimen. He literally bullies his way to the basket at times and through people. Now, some of the things I don't like, of course, he can flop a little bit more, and I want zero flopping, so obviously more than I would like him to do. However, his physicality puts him in a class almost in his own. He is, to the people that argued with the Jordan and LeBron debate, he is bigger and I guess overall stronger, I would say, for their size. I'd probably actually give the edge to Jordan there, but he is bigger, stronger, faster than Jordan was. However, this is also a very different NBA. He plays in a league where you have 6'9", 6'8" guys playing center. And for a 6'8", 260-pound player in LeBron James, he can bully his way to the basket, as I mentioned earlier. Could he have done the same thing against power forwards and centers who were 6'10", 7'2", 260, 70 pounds, 280, 300 pounds? The answer is probably not. Then, again, this is a tricky one for me. I looked at skill level, right? What I saw. So LeBron's not a great shooter. He's not fundamentally a good shooter. And I know statistically, again, I'm keeping the statistics out of this. I understand you're going to say, well, their shooting percentages. Yeah, I get it. But I think we talked about if you eliminate the within 3 feet, so the dunks and those layups, LeBron's numbers go significantly lower. But just watching it, he looks awkward shooting his threes. And in a league that has become very three-point oriented, he's not a very good three-point shooter. He's actually below average in the NBA. So that being said, watching, I see a physically dominating specimen, like I said, but could he do what he does in Jordan's body, right? That's where I kind of turn the switch a little bit to the skill set. Well, no, he couldn't. He couldn't be as physically dominating as Jordan was. So that kind of is the negative side. When we look at Michael Jordan, the eye test, when you see him on the court, it's very clear he is the best, the most physical, the most skilled, and the hungriest person on the court offensively and defensively all the time. I don't think you could say that for any other player, let alone LeBron James, because the one thing, and I'm going to go back to LeBron for a second, that you notice with LeBron, yeah, he's clearly been the best player most years in the NBA, but you've had debates, right? There's been the him or KD, him or Kobe, right now him or Giannis, and that's been a constant, him or Kawhi, right? There's been that constant, is he the dominant best player even in his own era? Now, of course, because of longevity, you're going to say, yes, he is, because he's done what he's done longer than anybody else. When it comes to Jordan, he was clearly the best player on the court all the time. And people knock him for that, and they say, oh, the competition wasn't as good. Listen, I'm not going to debate the competition. I'm only going to say this. You play the teams that are in front of you. You play the players that are in front of you. That's why, again, I'll go off topic a little bit when I say, when people say, oh, this team or that team should have an asterisk next to its championship. No, they shouldn't. They won those games. They deserve to be the champion. Unless they cheated somehow, every team has injuries. Every team has, you know, bad bounces, unlucky, whatever the case may be. You play who's in front of you, teams and players. And if you win, you win. That's it. You're the best. Over. End of conversation. That's why they play the games. If you don't like it, don't watch. If you don't want to deal with it as an athlete, don't play. So when he's clearly the best for 10 years in his profession, leaves, comes back, he's still the best. What my eyes tell me is he's the greatest player of all time. So the last check mark for the eye test for me goes to Michael Jordan. With the WNBA teams making their way to Florida to start their 22-game season, we continue our preview of WNBA teams. This week, we're talking about the Chicago Sky. So there's some positives and some opportunities for the Sky this year, because one of the things that's going to be very difficult for all the teams, whether they were in the layoff like the NBA or NHL, we're trying to start fresh in a couple of months here, like the NFL is doing. The continuity and the ability to get your team chemistry together fast enough to make a run, especially in a season like this of only 22 games, you have to do it very quickly. And this is where the Chicago Sky actually have an advantage over some of the other teams heading into this year's season. They brought back almost the entire core from last year's team. So Vandersloot, Quigley, Dolson have all re-signed, and DeShields and Williams are back on their rookie contracts, and their pickup of Vazura Stevens and Sydney Colson, and obviously their rookie, can fit in nicely to a team that's already got some chemistry and has already played together. So many other teams are going to be struggling to build that chemistry in a short 2-week training camp. They'll probably be able to get off to a quicker start, and with a short season, that's going to be very important. Where's the opportunity for Chicago Sky this year? And that's going to be on the defensive side. So offensively, last year, they were second only to Washington in points scored, 101.6 per 100 possessions. The problem is they gave up almost just as many points on defense as they scored on offense, 100.1. Now, that was the worst defensive team to qualify for the playoffs last year. That is something that they'll definitely need to work on. The good news is Stevens and Colson should help their defense significantly. So look for the Chicago Sky to have a great opportunity in this shortened season to make some noise. Now to Major League Baseball, where an entire team finds itself homeless. The Toronto Blue Jays are not going to be allowed to play in Toronto this year. For obvious reasons, and I don't disagree with the Ontario or Canadian government making the decision not to allow them to play here. Having players and or family travel back and forth between Canada and the US is dangerous. COVID is real, and we have to take precautions. So I get that. So where will the Blue Jays play this year? I hope it's not a sign of things to come, because I think the fans of Toronto are fantastic. And when the Blue Jays are in contention, it is a pretty strong fan base. However, here are the options, and we're cutting it really close because the season starts on July 23rd. The Blue Jays' first game is on July 24th versus Tampa, but their first official, I guess, home opener isn't until 5 days later against Washington. So here are the options. They can go play in their spring training facility in Dunedin, Florida. And I actually think that's an okay short-term solution, but it's not a major league ballpark. And one of the things that players and coaches have asked for when looking for a place to relocate has been a major league ballpark. But the facility in Dunedin is nice, the weather's nice, and it's something that they're familiar with in terms of their players and coaches. So getting around might be easier than starting off in a new city. Option number two, Buffalo. Buffalo has come to the table and their minor league team plays out of Buffalo. And they've said, hey, we want you. We'd love for you to be here. Buffalo, if you don't know, is probably about an hour and 30 minutes drive away from Toronto. So although, again, they probably won't be allowed to cross back and forth across the border, there's some familiarity. It's close enough. It's very similar feel to it. And as some of their younger players may have played in the minor league system in Buffalo, again, there's some familiarity. The one that's kind of come, at least for me, out of left field has been Camden Yards. So Toronto playing in Baltimore. Now, that's an interesting one because obviously you got the Orioles playing there. But I think it fits one of the biggest needs or wants of the Blue Jays organization, which is to have a stadium that's a major league ballpark. This fits that bill. So Toronto would play in Camden Yards. Here's the issue. In September, there's no issue because Baltimore and Toronto do not have one home game on the same day in the month of September. Now, they do have some in July and August where they could either create some sort of doubleheader situation, or they can always play at National Park. That is available for those times where the team's games overlap. I'm not sure what they're going to pick, and it is getting pretty close to, if not already, deadline time for the Blue Jays to decide. If it were up to me, I'd go with Baltimore and Camden Yards. I really like the idea of them being in a major league park. And every game, although it might feel like an away game, I still think it's better than playing in some smaller minor league parks, which just, I think it's a bad look. So good luck to the Blue Jays on finding a home, and good luck with this season. Now for the fix. Yes, NFL fans, you get the fix this week when we talk about the NFL's plans to keep players safe coming back from COVID-19. So one of the things that they've done after a bunch of players have come out on social media complaining about their lack of a plan, they've decided to eliminate all the exhibition games. Now that's something that players have been asking for years, so I think it's a small win, but I know that it's just something to get the players back on side with their lack of being prepared. They've had 4 months to figure out what they want to do, and I don't think they're ready yet. Doing daily tests is good, but that plan is only for 2 weeks. That's something that should be season long, or at least until it's deemed that, okay, we can stop testing for this. I don't think they will this season. The other thing is, how can they keep their players safe? They're not doing the bubble as some of the other sports, you know, the NBA, the NHL, etc., are doing. They're letting players travel back and forth between their homes. That obviously puts them at greater risk being in contact with friends and family, etc. So they have to be more cautious. A positive COVID test means right away, is it a 2 week, I don't want to call it suspension, but a 2 week layoff for any player that's tested positive. If a player tests positive, does that mean that the entire team has to be on quarantine or tested more regularly? I don't know. That's something that they need to figure out. The other part is, what about the refs when games start to play? They're going to go with no exhibition, very little to no contact in training camps. So will players be ready to take those hits, and will the product on the field be very sloppy because they won't be very prepared? They're just jumping into play. Veterans may be okay. Rookies are going to have a really hard time. So I've mentioned the refs. Referees. Does it mean less referees on the field and maybe more in the booth? This is a great opportunity to try out my plan where the replay booth are actual referees and officials who are calling down calls directly to the on-field refs and getting the play right in real time versus having to go back up for an instant replay and have them watch it over and over again and still get the call wrong. So can they save some contact there by adding more people into the booth? Obviously, there'll be no fans, at least in the beginning. But let me know what you think. Will the NFL be back on time? Will they get a COVID strategy that the players will accept? That's it for episode 33 of Sports Fluent. I'm your host, Anthony K. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram and Twitter at sports_fluent. Or email me your thoughts directly, AnthonyK@sportsfluent.com. Also, we have some news that we wanted to share. We have joined the Worst Take Network. What's the Worst Take Network? It's a group of sports podcasts where we give you our insights and opinions, like I do every week on Sports Fluent. Plus, on our social media, we give you some of the worst takes in sports. So don't forget to check that out. Until next week.